current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back with summer just about here. Be aware that USA Today has ranked One Michigan Highway as one of the country's most beautiful coastal drives. They rank the top 10 here. And apparently M37, you drive down M37 near Traverse City, it came in 7th on their list of 10 most beautiful coastal drives in the United States. Be aware of that. With summer just about here, maybe you can make a plan to drive down that road. Later this hour, Mythbusters is coming to Wharton Center. We'll visit with them and guests from Lansing's Finner Nature Center, a real jewel of a place for the city. We will talk about some of the programs that they operate at Fenner coming up and more here this hour on Current State. At the top here, the ongoing debate over auto insurance reform in Michigan added a new wrinkle last week. Reform advocates like Governor Rick Snyder, the insurance industry, many motorists, and our first guest complain about the state's premiums, currently the 8th highest in the country. They say it's the price Michigan pays for uncapped payouts to victims of catastrophic accidents. Those can go well into the millions of dollars. A bill in the state Senate would cap lifetime payouts at $1 million per claim. Now, defenders of the system insist that before capping benefits, more needs to be known about how key rates are set. That's done by a group called the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association. Every auto owner in Michigan pays the yearly assessment that the MCCA sets. Right now, that's $175 a year. To explain the pro-reform position and what happened last week, we are joined now by Kevin Clinton. Mr. Clinton's director of the Michigan Department of Insurance and Financial Services. He is also a non-voting member of the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association. Welcome to Current State.
Well, thank you very much.
Before we get into last week's FOIA request, that's really the development from last week, let's at the start here try to help our listeners understand more of the larger debate over no-fault reform. On one hand, the governor, some number of Michigan drivers, many in the insurance industry, and you maintain that premiums are too high, largely because of these uncapped settlements that Michigan law allows. As a reform proponent, what would you add to that side of the debate?
Well, I think what is happening with the cost of the auto insurance is it's really hurting our economic recovery in Michigan. There are people, I think about 20% of the state is uninsured, and primarily because the rates are too high. In the large cities, that 20% could be 40% or even 50%. And how do you maintain a job if you can't drive a car? So I think we have a problem in the state, and I think you stated earlier that we were probably 8th, but because of the uninsured we have, which is primarily in the large, more costly, large cities, our average rate in the state is probably the highest in the nation if you add the uninsured in there that should be buying insurance but don't.
I think Detroit is one example of a place where rates are extraordinarily high. They can go well into the hundreds of dollars per month, correct?
Yes, and they say the average premium in Detroit is approximately $6,000, and I think the average income in Detroit is about $35,000 a year. So people simply can't afford it.
Let's look at the legislation that would cap these benefits. This is House Bill 4612. It would, and correct me if I'm wrong, it would cap future settlements at $1 million. Now, people currently receiving lifetime uncapped benefits would continue to receive them. The Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association, which sets the dollar amount every Michigan auto owner pays to help cover claims over $500,000, the MCCA would be phased out. Now, that body plays a central role in this debate, and you are a non-voting member, pardon me, as head of the Department of Insurance and Financial Services. As simply as you can, Kevin, tell us how the MCCA arrives at that figure, please. It is set to jump, by the way, on July 1st.
Yes, the MCCA will be phased out, the current MCCA, and replaced by MCCA number 2. So it will be replaced, and it will cover If the cap is at $1 million, it will cover anything over $500,000 up to $1 million. So it is not being eliminated. The current one is getting phased out, which will be replaced by a new one. But in setting the rates, what they have done is, you know, they have experience on auto accidents, I mean, severe auto accidents since 1978. And the MCCA uses their own particular experience to set the rates. So they look at the severity of the catastrophic injuries. They estimate what those costs on those catastrophic injuries are going to be. And they use a pension-type model. They discount this back to present value on investment income. So in other words, if your life expectancy is expected to be another 30 years, they take all the investment income that you're going to earn on the premiums for the next 30 years and bring them back to present value. So people, the revenues for the MCCA are both the premiums that they will collect and the future investment income they will collect, and that has to cover their costs.
Now, the people most severely injured in Michigan auto accidents, along with the Michigan Hospitals Association, these are reform opponents, say that a safety net for severely injured people would be taken away with these changes. Are they wrong? And if so, how?
Well, Michigan is the only state in the nation that has unlimited medical benefits. In fact, the next highest state only has 50,000 mandated as a maximum or as a minimum, and that's New York, $50,000. So our million will still be 20 times higher than the next highest state. So we'll still have the best benefits in the nation. So what happens in other states is they rely on their medical coverage to pay for auto accidents, in which we don't. So 1114, everybody in the state is supposed to be carrying, according to the Affordable Care Act, everyone is supposed to be carrying health insurance. So everyone is supposed to have that health insurance to rely on for auto accidents. So I think we can safely bring that down to $1 million and have your health insurance and your auto insurance cover an auto accident.
But
in the event, go ahead.
But it still looks to be an instance of cost shifting in some respect. I mean, we're talking about costs of the insurance sector shifting to, at least for covering catastrophic care, moving from insurance companies to Medicaid. I mean, people, I'm presuming here, people would plead poverty if faced with long-term costs that exceed $1 million and go to Medicaid. How is that not a cost shifting of a fashion?
Well, I don't think it's a cost shifting because right now we have 20% of our population uninsured. So any accident that they get in, it doesn't even necessarily have to be a severe accident. That will throw them into Medicaid. So I think it will be a cost savings to Medicaid and not a cost drain to Medicaid.
I'm wondering if you could evaluate this thing politically, if you don't mind. Some Democrats predicted a pretty cool reception to this measure when it was first brought up. Parts of this are also in the courts. Are you generally encouraged, discouraged, or what?
Well, I'm not a political person myself, but I am fascinated by the politics of it. I think the areas of the state that it will help the most, which are a lot of the urban areas that we're pushing for because the costs are so high in the urban areas, a lot of the representatives in those areas are Democratic, and they tend to be against this, which surprised me. And then this, in my opinion, the Michigan auto no-fault is more like a lot of it is very similar to the Affordable Care Act, which many people call Obamacare. It's mandated insurance, unlimited. And a lot of the Republicans who are very much against Obamacare are for continuing on with our current no-fault system. So I guess the politics do amaze me to some extent.
Defenders of the current uncapped system filed a Freedom of Information Act request recently claiming that before reforms are considered, that rate-setting operations of the MCCA ought to enjoy some sunlight. You, in your role as insurance and financial services director, denied that request. Why?
Because if we were required to deny that under the insurance code. The insurance code has a section 134, which states that the records of an association or facility shall be exempted from disclosure And they went on to define what they mean by an association. And the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association was specifically cited as one of those entities that is exempted from disclosure. And we even looked at, because I ran it by our general counsel, and one of the questions I asked him is, well, you know, it says they shall be exempted, and does that mean we have our option that we can hand this information over or not? And his reply was that it states that it shall be exempted. And he said, therefore, the exemption is mandated, and we don't have the discretion to disclose those records.
Okay, Kevin Clinton is director of the Michigan Department of Insurance and Financial Services. He is also a non-voting member of the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association. Mr. Clinton, thanks for joining us this morning on Current State. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much.
Let's get another perspective now. Michael Dabbs is president of the Brain Injury Association of Michigan, based in Ann Arbor, and he joins us live in our Current State studio. How are you?
Good morning, Mark. Good to be with you.
Michael, what stands out for you among Mr. Clinton's comments?
Well, I think there's a couple of points. First of all, Mr. Clinton mentioned that there's upwards of 20%+, and in perhaps some of the urban areas as much as 50% who are driving uninsured.
Yes.
Well, that's to be sure. I don't know that either you or I could afford $6,000 in insurance, regardless of the income we were making. I think that, to me, calls into question the whole rate-making setup that insurance uses. Second of all, I think the whole idea, too, that somehow that this reform measure that is being suggested, and as the governor and Mr. Clinton both have stated, the savings are $125. Now, common sense tells you nobody is going to go rushing out to buy insurance in those urban areas because it's $125 cheaper when it's cost $6,000.
Okay.
Well, so I think, you know, that's certainly an issue. I think the this whole issue, too, that he referred to the Affordable Care Act a couple of times. Well, the fact is the state legislature has not embraced the Affordable Care Act. In fact, they have fought it. And in my understanding right now is the state of Michigan come October 1 will be required to use a federal model instead of doing what they should have done, which was to adopt a plan of their own. Additionally, the state legislature hasn't expanded Medicaid. And yet, as you stated, that's where a lot of these folks that are catastrophically injured will end up going on to. So bottom line, you know, the only people who are going to win in this one is going to be the insurance companies, not the people of Michigan.
What did you this FOIA request that you and your allies were behind that was denied by Mr. Clinton last week, I believe, he defended the denial of the FOIA request. What remind our listeners what you were looking for in that
Sure.
FOIA request.
Well, what we've done in the FOIA request is exactly the same that was done in a court proceeding that's currently being heard at the Court of Appeals, or will be here a little bit later this summer. And effectively, it asks for specific data, things like what is the actuarial assumptions that have been used on the return of investments? What is the actuarial assumptions on the cost of care going forward? Because if you don't know those things, you cannot judge whether or not the actual premiums that they're setting to be correct.
He maintained that he was required to deny the FOIA because of language in the state insurance code. Had you heard that before, or what do you make of that?
You know, personally, I'm not a lawyer, so I really cannot speak to that part of it. And no, I had not heard that before. I certainly saw it in his denial letter. My sense of it, though, is I run a nonprofit association. I've been the head of a nonprofit association for over 30 years. And I can tell you that even in the nonprofit world, one of the most critical requirements is transparency. That's what's missing here. I think Mr. Clinton, not only wearing his hat as the insurance commissioner, but a member of the MCCA board, should be doing everything possible to make sure that this information is transparent. And just to perhaps anticipate what might be said by Mr. Clinton or others, this information is not available to the public in any fashion currently, and that's the reason why we're in court trying to get it and why we FOIA'd Mr. Clinton.
Michigan doesn't just lead the nation in catastrophic accident payouts. It far exceeds the closest states, as Kevin Clinton pointed out. Mm-hmm. Reformers proposed this reduction to $1 million. They claim New York is second with a mandatory medical coverage of only $50,000. How do you respond to that? This would still be a relatively, if they cut it down to $1 million, they maintain this would be a relatively generous program. Why are you satisfied only with payouts that exceed the national average by such an incredible margin?
Sure. You know, I think the gist of it is this. How do we want to take care of people who are catastrophically injured? In Michigan, we've chosen to say we want the people who are on our roads, who register a car, to help pay for their care, to take care of them for the person's lifetime. And why? Because we've given up our right to sue. And that's the alternative here, is if in all of these other states, they have to sue to get the care they need. Now, let me take that a step further for you. When you file a lawsuit, doesn't mean you're going to get all of the rehabilitation care that you need immediately. For people with brain injuries, you must get care immediately. You must get the first year to 2 years are the most critical time in a person's recovery from a brain injury in particular. Over 60%, nearly 66% of the cases in the MCCA are those of brain injury.
Are there many, many more lawsuits in the other states compared to Michigan?
Well, let's just give you this fact. Michigan ranks 49th out of 50 states in the number of lawsuits.
Okay. So that would seem to underscore your point. What exactly is your message, Michael, for drivers in Detroit who might well be paying $300 a month or more? I think Kevin Clinton quoted even $6,000 as high is not unheard of. How do you explain this scenario to people who are just fed up with the rates?
You know, we're fed up with it too. And I think it's high time that we empowered Mr. Clinton to have the authority to look at what the rates that are being charged. Interestingly enough, Mr. Clinton and the insurance commissioner's office, not just Mr. Clinton, but his office, is about 40th in the nation in terms of having the power to enforce insurance regulations. I think we give him the power and let him do his job as good as he can.
How big of a setback was the FOIA denial?
It wasn't totally unanticipated, but we were hoping that perhaps he would come forward with it, and I appreciate his efforts in trying to at least clear it with his general counsel, but we'll continue the battle in the courts.
Is it fair to ask what you're inclined to think a FOIA would have revealed had it been approved?
You know, Mark, I really don't know. To be very frank, there is no reason to believe that there's any sort of shenanigans going on here or any sort of ill purposes or anything like that.
Really?
But
not necessarily.
But let's verify. You know, you in order to have trust, you must be able to verify.
We're going to invoke Ronald Reagan here.
Oh, you betcha.
Is that right? It's currently being appealed here, as we mentioned, that this is in the courts. How long do you expect to wait for any kind of decision?
You know, I think the courts are sensitive to this issue, and I believe the Court of Appeals will move fairly quickly. My suspect is that regardless of which side should win that court battle, it'll probably go to the Supreme Court.
Okay, very good. Michael Dabbs is the Executive Director of the Brain Injury Association of Michigan, and we appreciate your joining us here today on Current State.
Thank you.
It's Wednesday, and it's time for Current State's Neighbors in Action segment, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. This week, we feature Lansing's Fenner Nature Center. The center spans 134 acres with more than 4 miles of trails on Lansing's south side. Here to tell us more about Fenner Nature Center is program manager Katie Woodhams, and joining her is one of the Nature Center's most prized youth volunteers, Nathan Martineau. Nathan recently received the Mayor's Hometown Hero Award. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Katie, start by telling us a little bit about this jewel that is the Fenner Nature Center. It's been around for more than 50 years, and it's 134 acres at Mount Hope and Aurelius Road.
Exactly. You know, I grew up in this area, and to be honest, I didn't even know Fenner existed until a few years ago. So it's definitely a hidden gem. We like to call it that, but at the same time, we want more people to know more about it. That way, people like Nathan and some of our volunteers and the community itself can enjoy the resource that is there. So there is 134 acres. It's smack dab in the middle of the city. It's an urban green space. And because of that, we see all sorts of wildlife. You know, it's really an oasis for them, especially during migration time. We get a lot of birders and people that like to, you know, just check out the environment and the type of animals and plants that are there. But it's also a recreation destination. So those trails that you mentioned, we have people all the time on those walking and doing whatever.
It's a pretty special place. Now, you offer a variety of programs for youth. Tell us about a few of them.
Well, we have our school programs all year round and some of our summer camps and things that happen, like a traditional nature center. But we also try to push the limits a little bit. So Nathan is one of our youth leaders in our youth leadership program, which is a way for us to engage those older kids, so 11 to 17, who maybe just want to sit on the couch or maybe not sure really what to do with themselves, but they're not sure as far as career opportunities and natural resources as well. So getting them involved in volunteer opportunities and giving them leadership and job skills is one of the programs that we like to mentor.
Nathan Martineau, what do you like most about being involved at Fenner Nature Center?
Well, I really like the youth leadership program.
That's your main thing?
Well, I started out mostly watching birds, and I did a big project over there. And so I was really excited when the youth leadership program came out. And
How long have you been involved with the center? When did you first go? When did you first visit the Nature Center?
When I was 4 or 5, I think.
Oh my, okay. And you're how old now?
16.
Okay, and you've been a volunteer for how long?
About 3 years.
Yeah, so Nathan came to me last year and asked if he could actually compete for the American Birding Association's Young Birder of the Year Award, which is a national competition for youth. And his biggest concern at the time was if he could get off the trails and do some nest monitoring. And he was concerned that I wouldn't let him, or we wouldn't let him go off the trails, because that's a typical rule at nature centers. So he actually submitted a proposal to me for his project, and we gave him the green light. And, you know, almost 200, I don't know how many volunteer hours you've put in, to be honest. It's insane. But doing everything from nest monitoring, bird watching and counting, you know, our migration. He's helping us collect data about the animals and plants that are at Fenner, because that data has been collected for 50-odd years, and there's been a gap lately. So he's actually filled that gap and done some citizen scientist work for us and helped us with education. He went to the Capitol with me last year and educated the public. So he's very humble, but he actually won 3rd place in this national competition in overall for his conservation work at Fenner.
What do you think you've learned? What's been the best thing that you've learned since you've been involved at Fenner so closely?
Well, I've learned how few people really know about the natural world and yet how easy it is to educate them about it. I think that's important. Because, I mean, obviously to conserve, you know, places like Fenner, people need to know about them and care about them.
Well, they have to experience them, too.
Yeah.
And you experienced it at a very young age, and it made an impression on you. Do you find that people are coming to the Fenner Nature Center for the first time, or is it mostly return visits?
It really varies. You know, I love talking to visitors when they come in and, you know, asking them whether they've been before or in the past. And it's really interesting. There's people that have lived in the Lansing area their whole lives, and sometimes it's the first time they've ever been in. I actually spoke with a lady who was in, you know, she was a senior, and she said, last time I was here, this building was brand new. And it took me aback because the building actually opened in 1962. And I thought, well, I asked her, did you move away? No, I've lived down the street my whole life. So this person had almost a 50-year gap in visits to the Nature Center that's in her backyard.
How about that? Nathan, do you have career plans then or career thoughts that involve nature or biology or the outdoor world?
Certainly. I really want to be a field ecologist.
A field ecologist involving birds?
Birds, plants, insects.
Any number of
yeah.
things. How many birds on your life list? Do you keep a life list? I'm curious.
I just went to Florida, so it just
Ooh.
Pretty much exploded. It, so
Florida's the place. Sure. If you're your first trip to Florida, your life list explodes. There's no doubt about that. Have you logged a bald eagle yet? You have?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not uncommon in Florida. Katie, how does funding work for Fenner Nature Center? I understand, actually, you've attracted national attention in your efforts as to how to fund a nature center.
Right. A lot of people don't realize this, but Fenner is actually a city park. It's owned, you know, the property and the building have been owned by the city of Lansing since the mid-50s. But recently, in about 4 years ago, there was a transition that occurred, and actually our Friends group that started in 1980 called Friends of Fenner actually took over as the managing entity of the daily operations. So myself and our executive director, we're actually employees of the nonprofit Fenner Conservancy. And we lease the property and building from the city of Lansing for $1 a year and maintain the daily operations while the city, you know, helps us with maintenance, they help us with plowing, all of those operational costs that we don't have to fundraise for. It's a beautiful partnership. We work well together. And really, we couldn't maintain the building without them, and they couldn't deliver the program quality that we could. That, you know, we can help with that.
But are you staffed and funded as adequately as you would like?
Well, I don't think anybody has ever staffed and funded as adequately as they like, especially when we have such huge ideas and goals. You know, we'd love to have all these different programs and just have the place teeming with naturalists. Alas, that's not really reasonable.
But it's not like you're only open on weekends either.
No, we're open all week. We're closed on Mondays. But really, it's a great opportunity. That's why volunteers and members of Fenner Conservancy are so important, because they're helping us on the ground doing programs like the Youth Leadership Program and Stewardship and taking care of the park. But the city does own the property, so your taxes are going a little bit in towards, you know, plowing the roads and maintaining that property so that it's not developed.
Nathan, what are you doing right now in field school? What are your activities actually in the field at Fenner right now?
Well, right now I'm doing a study on how deer affect plants that are native to Michigan.
I can tell you a lot about how deer impact plants.
Yeah.
Especially if you own ewes. Tell
yeah.
us more.
So I've cleared 2 plots in the woods, and I'm going to plant some native plants, columbine and aster, and I'm going to treat them with different treatments that are, mm-hmm. you know, like deer repellents.
Gotcha.
And see which one works best.
Okay.
And that's one thing. And then the spring season just finished. I just finished my second year of spring migration monitoring.
What did you find there?
I don't know. This year was a lot less active than last year. The weather sort of forced the migrants toward the lake fronts, and so all the migrants just went up the lakes and none went inland, so there was very... There were very few birds this year.
Katie, how can people listening right now and impressed with what you do at Fenner, how can they get involved?
Well, we have our website, mynaturecenter.org, and there's actually an interactive volunteer form online. They can fill out and check the things they want to be interested in helping out with, such as stewardship or leading programs, helping in the office. And then we only contact them for things they're interested in. And I won't bug you too much about, you know, things that you didn't check that you were interested in. There's information about our programs there. And, of course, I always encourage people just to walk in, because then you kind of you get addicted to the place like we all are, and then you won't want to leave. So
how many days a week are you at Fenner, Nathan?
Usually about four.
About four days a week.
Yeah.
And for the young people listening about your age, you'd recommend a visit, I imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. It opened your eyes when you first visit. How can they be more like you? There's a lot for them to do that they could join you.
Well, you don't have to watch birds like I do. Certainly, you can just go take a picnic or walk the trails a little bit or go and look around inside the nature center.
Yeah.
Whatever suits you.
It can be educational and it can be just fun, too.
Mm-hmm.
Katie Woodhams is the program manager at the Fenner Nature Center. Nathan Martineau is one of the center's youth leaders. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Current State could always use more nominations, and we know there are great people and organizations out there that are doing great work, and we just don't know about them. If you'd like one to be featured on our Neighbors in Action segment, please send us an email. That's currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Michigan State University has long sought to be a leader in the field of global health. This afternoon, the university takes another step in that pursuit by breaking ground on a new 130,000-square-foot bioengineering facility on campus. When completed in 2015, the new building will bring medicine and engineering together in projects that will benefit each field. Here to talk about the new facility, Dr. Jeffrey Dwyer. He's the Senior Associate Dean for Research with the MSU College of Human Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Dwyer.
Well, good morning. Thank you.
And also with me is Dr. Manoush Kuchisfani, Associate Dean for Graduate Studies and Faculty Development with the MSU College of Engineering.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
Welcome to you. And the focus of the new facility, Dr. Dwyer, is explicitly global health?
Well, that we expect global health will be part of it, but this is really an important milestone for our colleges in the development of something called the Institute for Engineering, Science, and Health. It's been a conversation going on for several years, first started with Dean Satish Upta in engineering, who's now the Executive VP for Administrative Services, and Marcia Rapley, the Dean of the College of Human Medicine. And this is an opportunity to bring together some very talented people that we currently have in our colleges, as well as the opportunity to recruit some new people to help us address a number of biomedical, bioengineering issues, and we expect that some of them will have global health implications.
Dr. Kuchisfani, could you give our listeners one example of the kind of research that will be conducted in this facility?
Well, one is easy. There's quite a bit of work that will go on. I'll give you one example. There's quite a bit of interaction between engineering faculty and research that's related to neurology, okay, for example. And you can imagine that there's a lot of good basic science that goes on in the field of neurology. And in the medical field, they know what the needs are, what the patient's needs are. And engineers are very good in designing gadgets. And so when you put these talents together, they can help each other for delivering better care for patients. For example, engineers are very good in designing sensors to measure things.
Sure.
And based on that, determine what the need is For example, imagine that you had a sensor that could pick up information about the brain activity and convey that information directly to the practitioners, health practitioners, say, oh, this is a weakness. This is where need is needed to for the health care of the patient. So these are the kinds of things. We measure all sorts of things by medical devices. We don't always know how to interpret those signals, what the real implication is. So we have faculty in engineering that their sort of expertise is processing signals, trying to get information, useful information from signals that are generated by these medical devices, whether it's for heart, for brain, for other things, and say, oh, this is telling me something is about to happen to the heart.
Okay. So. We're talking with Dr. Manoush Kuchisfani and Dr. Jeffrey Dwyer about the groundbreaking this afternoon of Michigan State University's new bioengineering building. This is a 130,000 square foot project, and it brings together the medical and the engineering processes. Tissue engineering is also on your radar. Dr. Dwyer, can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so tissue engineering is a big part of where we think the synergies can occur. I could just, you know, refer to something that some of us in our college have experienced recently. We have a colleague in our dean's office whose son suffered severe burns in a military accident, and those burns have healed quicker and better than they might have in the past, in part because of the utilization of matrices for growing single-layer skin cell platforms. And that's now a clinical application that has now impacted someone that we happen to know in our college. But it was derived over years by engineers and physicians getting together and understanding what the need was, how to make it work technically on the engineering side, and then how to apply it in a healthcare context.
Will this facility have an economic impact for Mid-Michigan? Will, for example, more people be working at MSU because of this facility?
That's an excellent question. We expect at least 30, 40 more faculty in engineering to be hired to enhance the activities of these facilities. And also, there would be a huge advantage in terms of educational and research activities of the students that would be involved. I'm not sure if you've heard this, but business leaders in Michigan have indicated that there is need for as many as 1,000 additional engineering graduates per year for the state of Michigan. So we hope that having this facility and the faculty, new faculty, and the students that it enables will help us meet some of those needs.
What about the human medicine school?
Well, the same applies, and I think an economic development piece that is important and is often sort of under the radar a little bit is that when we go hire these outstanding faculty, as our colleges have done in recent years and we expect to continue to do, they either bring with them or build when they're here whole teams of people, professionals that work with them. So it would be typical, for example, that a senior-funded scientist might have anywhere from 4 to 8 or 10 people working closely with them, some full-time, some students, some graduate students, but each of them has an economic impact in terms of the opportunity for really outstanding jobs and training, but they're in the area, they're spending money, they're really adding to the vitality of the community.
Fascinating dynamic. Where is the new building?
It's physically going to be located between the School of Nursing and the Clinical Center.
Okay.
There's an open area. If you drive by, you'll see.
Service Road.
Exactly. Right. And it's also near the Life Sciences building where a number of faculty already do their work that will interact with folks in this facility. And it's also near an important animal facility, which will help with the research.
Is there any kind of consensus as to the leading challenges under the heading global health?
Well, I think certainly at MSU, an area that we spend a lot of time thinking about and have some really outstanding faculty working in is infectious diseases.
Okay.
So we've recently hired in areas like tuberculosis, for example, that has both human and animal implications around the world, including in the state of Michigan. And so, you know, Michigan State is one of those. I had the opportunity to be in Malawi in Africa not too long ago with some colleagues. And when you do have the chance to go around the world, you really see the impact that Michigan State University has truly on an international scale.
Will the third world be the main beneficiary of what happens here, or will people living in the West, in the United States, how much will they benefit?
No, a great deal of it is also impacting, you know, folks, you and me and our children in the future. Imagine that we have all sorts of people who have injuries, brain injuries, physical injuries, and we're trying to design devices that will help them recover sooner with the medical knowledge that is available on the basic research. And the engineers are hoping to design gadgets that help them recover sooner or redirect the brain function so the brain can recover some of its original activity. So who is a beneficiary of that? Everyone in the world. But first, because it's done here, we are the first beneficiary of it. You know?
Dr. Manoj Kucheswani, I beg your pardon. Dr. Manoj Kucheswani is Associate Dean for Graduate Studies and Faculty Development at the MSU College of Engineering. And Dr. Jeffrey Dwyer is Senior Associate Dean for Research with the MSU College of Human Medicine. We've been talking about the new bioengineering facility at Michigan State. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Television's most explosive science show is on tour with a stop in East Lansing this weekend. The hosts of Discovery Channel's Mythbusters will present Behind the Myths, featuring onstage experiments, audience participation, and their usual unorthodox approach to science. WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with Mythbusters co-host Adam Savage, who, along with Janie Heineman, we'll be bringing a slightly unplugged version of the show to Wharton Center. Melissa began by asking Savage how many explosions he'd presided over during the show's 10-year run.
I think we just did some stats on this, that it comes out to just shy of 3,000 over the last 10 years.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, that's across both teams. I'd say I'd be responsible for about 2,000 of those.
Okay. Well, I mean, in skydiving terms, your first 1,000, you're considered a veteran. So, 2,000, you're getting up there. So what is the Cliff Notes version of how you ended up hosting Mythbusters? Because it sounds like a lot of your previous work was behind the scenes with various kinds of artistic design and special effects and that kind of thing.
It was actually behind the scenes. I did, however, start out wanting to be an actor when I was about 15 years old.
Oh, really?
That was the first thing that I thought that I really wanted to. Well, actually, the first job I ever wanted was to be a designer for Lego. The second was to work on Star Wars. And then somewhere in my early teens, I started to act in the school plays, and I really thought that that's something that I wanted to do, and I studied it very seriously for about 5 years, stopping somewhere around the age of 19, and then really ending up making things for a living for about more like 10 or 15 years. I started out in graphic design, assistant animation, moving into theater. And theater, I learned scenic painting, master carpentry, rigging, welding. I worked as an assistant for an artist for a while and learned some more advanced machining and electronics work there. And the theater work here in San Francisco, which I was doing in the early 90s, caught the attention of a special effects shop that was being run by Jamie Heineman. And he brought me in and hired me in my first real job in commercial special effects. I worked for Jamie for about 5 years. When I couldn't stand him as a boss, we stayed professionally cordial, but I moved on and worked in the toy industry and then up at Industrial Light and Magic on films now, on special effects films.
And you did do Star Wars a bit, yes?
Yeah, I actually did get to work on Star Wars, episode 1 and 2. And then when Mythbusters called in early 2002, they were cleverly looking for people who already had experience building everything. And that's exactly the kind of experience that you get when you're working in special effects. You know, there's no technique that you might eschew if it's going to help you out. And good special effects guys tend to be real materials polymaths. And it just turned out to be a perfect match of material with personality. You know, Jamie and I, the show ended up really sort of growing up around us.
And were you hesitant at first to go back to working with the person who had previously been your boss?
No, I didn't. We sent in a demo reel. It really all happened before it wasn't like I made a conscious decision at any given point. You know, Jamie called and said, these people called, they want a demo reel. Do you want to help me out with this? And let's do it. And I said, yeah. And then we sent to the demo reel and they loved it. And they showed up 3 weeks later to shoot the pilots. We shot the pilots for 6 weeks. And then the show premiered in January of 2003 to a really great rating. And we had been told that Discovery was going to take a couple of months to make this decision. In fact, they called us within a week and said, we're picking up the show. We start shooting in a month. And Jamie and I have never stopped filming Mythbusters since that moment. We've been shooting 46 weeks a year for the last 10 and a half years.
Wow. So your background is in building pretty much anything, and you do that on the show. But what kind of objects or projects, if any, do you just find frustrating and difficult to build?
That is a really good question. Almost everything carries with it a certain amount of frustration. But any given material or process in and of itself isn't usually inherently frustrating. Isn't usually inordinately frustrating. It's usually when you're trying to marry either two or three different techniques or genres of making. You know, it's funny. It's like, no matter how long I've been building stuff, and now I do most of my building in my head before I sit down. You know, it's like I do a lot of problem solving just mentally before I ever touch a material. But still, within almost any project that I'm doing, there's this time I just think, I have no idea what I'm doing. This is, I shouldn't be wasting this time. You know, I don't know electronics as well as I wish I did, but that doesn't stop me from diving in if I have to. There are all sorts of things I'd love to learn that I haven't gotten enough chance to do on the show, like really more advanced welding, and very specifically like steel manufacturing, like suits of armor. I've always wanted to work with more elaborate equipment to manipulate sheet metal.
Your show is notable for having lots of busting on it. Cars, dropped food, airbags, explosions. How do you take Mythbusters on the road to a genteel velvet-curtained theater like Wharton Center without causing the place to look like a hotel after a visit from Keith Moon?
Well, yeah, we labored a lot about figuring out how to take Mythbusters out on the road. And, you know, the biggest problem is was that we knew from the get-go we weren't going to be bringing actual experiments onto the stage. And the real problem with that is, and we knew this, was that, you know, on the show, if we do an experiment and nothing happens, we can edit out the boring bits, but you can't do that on stage. So we knew that we had to, in order to keep the evening rolling, we wanted to do something. And we didn't just want to show up and do a bunch of science demonstrations either. We wanted it to be invigorating and exciting. And where we really latched onto was an understanding that it was in the sense of humor that we realized we could bring a Mythbusters experience to the stage and in audience participation, which is something we don't generally do on the show.
Right.
And so in the course of the Behind the Myth tour, we bring, I think, at least a dozen people up on stage over the course of the night. And we play with them, we mess with them, we alter their expectations and confound them, we pit them against each other. And because we're doing this, and we bring up young kids, we bring up older people, we bring up everybody, every show is really different, and that keeps it really fresh for us.
It seems like about every person with scientific connections that I interview, I ask this question of, but do you think there is a correlation between kids being allowed some unstructured time for lack of a better word, creative destruction? Do you think there's a correlation between that and having some aptitude for scientific thinking later in life?
I totally do. I'm a big believer in letting your kids be bored, because in that tension can be created a lot of really interesting personal experience. It is something that's harder and harder to do these days. I've got twin 14-year-olds. And I do think that, you know, the ability to, I guess a lot of the structured game and play that goes on these days is all around success. And it's not around competition, and it's not around failure. And I think that when you're screwing around by yourself, you're going to scrape your elbows, and you're going to, you know, get confounded by something you want to achieve, but you're going to learn that regular wonderful periodicity of failure that tempers all of our personalities and I think makes people much more bearable to hang around.
I promise to limit myself to only one really self-indulgent question. Okay. I understand you worked on Galaxy Quest, which is one of my all-time favorites. What did you do on Galaxy Quest?
I only worked on Galaxy Quest for about 2.5 weeks, but it is full stop, my favorite movie I worked on the whole time I worked at Industrial Light and Magic. Not because of what I got to do. I mean, I just built a small bit of the dry dock. When the ship is coming out of the Thermian dry dock and it scrapes against the side.
Oh, God, which is just excruciating and one of my all-time favorite scenes because it's so funny and so long.
Right, and so there's a shot where you can see this, you know, all the Thermians standing in formation in multiple windows.
Right, right.
And that is actually a practical effect. It's a piece of hardware that I laser cut and put together as a light box with film strips of actors behind them. And it took me 2 weeks to build and light. Took another painter another week to paint it. And it's not a truly spectacular piece of model making. It's exactly what was required. But I spent so many years working on films that I thought were real dogs, and it was nice to work on one that I think of as a nearly perfect film.
So there are myths, and then there are myths that are within a TV program's budget. If you had unlimited resources, money is no object, what myth would you jump at the chance to bust?
Well, we'd build a rocket ship and go to the moon and come back with a piece of Apollo hardware demonstrating that man had already been there.
Any other ones you can think of right offhand?
No, that's the main one. You know, that's the primary one that gets us both kind of excited. The idea of going to space and actually making a trip like that, with money and budget being, of course, no object.
Well, Adam Savage, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll enjoy having you here at Wharton Center over the weekend.
I can't wait. I'll see you guys this weekend.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
And a reminder that live backstage pass performances continue this evening at East Lansing's Hanna Community Center. Join us. Doors open at 6:30. Admission is free. It is first come, first served. Tomorrow on Current State, live music from a performer at this weekend's East Lansing Summer Solstice Jazz Festival. Join us and enjoy Arlene McDaniel tomorrow here on Current State. The executive producer of our show is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering. Emmanuel Berry and Becky McHenry also provided production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.